In a remarkable feat of immersive journalism, Jessica Bruder spent 3 years and travelled thousands of kilometres to write her book Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century. It was the inspiration, that book, for the movie, which scooped 3 Oscars, deservedly so. But the book is better. It's much more informative and gripping, and asks the question, how is it that in one of the world's most affluent countries, so many people cannot afford to retire, and are one broken axle away from homelessness? These are the van dwellers Jessica Bruder spent so long with, and she's with me now. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Kim.
That's a pleasure. Have you got your headset on?
I do. Is that all right?
Jelly good, yes. I was racing to... Well, I was trying not to race through the introduction so that you could get your headset on. So I'm happy to hear.
Thank you.
How many van dwellers are there in the United States, do you think?
I wish I could tell you that. But it's like herding cats, because everybody needs to have a fake address to receive everything from a driver's license to insurance. There's no formal census of it. Estimates, super conservatively, were tens of thousands. I would say hundreds of thousands. But again, it just depends on what slice of the pie you're looking at, because I focus mostly on older people. There are also younger people who are doing this now, and I think the numbers have probably gone up since I wrote the book.
I imagine that younger people are doing it, certainly since 2008, when the housing crisis, apart from anything else, happened, and people lost their homes.
Absolutely. And even going back further, we just have a really big problem in this country in that wages have been flat. We're stuck at a $7.25 federal minimum wage, and the cost of shelter keeps going up. And it's an untenable situation.
You quoted, I can't remember the data, but very few places, you said, in the United States where a full-time minimum wage worker can afford a one-bedroom apartment at the fair market rent. Which
yes,
is quite a revealing fact. I mean, that explains why people hit the road, right?
Absolutely. And it's sad, too, because it's really changed over time in the U.S. If you went back to even the mid-60s, somebody who was working full-time at the minimum wage could support an entire family. And now we have 2-income families where people are working multiple jobs each, and they can barely make it. It's not right.
This brings us to Amazon. Tell me about the, what do you call them? The camp force.
The camper force.
Camper
yes.
force.
Yeah, essentially, what I was reporting on this program, what it looked to me like was a geriatric migrant labor unit. In 2008, this program began, and Amazon's warehouses used to all be in pretty far-flung locations in a gambit to avoid sales tax and keep a competitive advantage. So they were often in locations where they couldn't get enough bodies on the floor, particularly during what they call peak season, which is the gear up to the Christmas holiday.
Hang on.
And lo and behold,
they're in those locations to avoid sales tax, did you say?
Yeah, I think that loophole has since been closed, but there's something called a tax nexus. And in the very beginning, Amazon's strategy was to not locate its warehouses where its biggest customer bases were, because then it wouldn't have to charge sales tax, and that would be an advantage. But now that the focus is on last mile delivery, it's changed a bit. Speed has become the name of the game. But yeah, Amazon is notorious for finding any way around taxes it can, as is Jeff Bezos.
And they set up Camper Force for specifically the nomads who work seasonally.
Absolutely.
What are called fulfillment centers. I love that title.
Yeah, that's a little Orwellian, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
They are not where you go to fulfill your dreams, I can tell you that. But fulfillment centers, the kind of work that I saw people doing who were, some even up in their 70s, and I heard about people in their early 80s, these were jobs that would have been challenging on younger and more able-bodied workers. I knew a gentleman in his 70s who was walking about 15 miles a day on concrete. As we know, they have very limited break time, they have productivity quotas. And for this particular workforce, it was an employer's dream come true because they're essentially plug-and-play labor. They show up with their housing. They plug into their hookups to get water and electricity. They're there for as long as they're needed, and then they depart. And the company really bears very little responsibility to them.
It's a win-win, right?
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's a win-win. It's definitely a win for somebody. But,
Well, I mean, Amazon,
you
from
know,
Amazon's point of view, they get
oh, yes, I'm.
free painkillers. What more do you want?
Oh, exactly. That's definitely a win. I still have free painkillers from my stint undercover in the Amazon warehouse.
So tell me how
So,
you
so thank you,
experienced it.
Amazon.
Tell me how you experienced it.
Sure. So I went undercover in a warehouse in Texas near Fort Worth. And I was one of only two people in my contingent who didn't have gray hair. So I kind of stuck out like a sore thumb. And we were in a newer warehouse, which meant that instead of doing endless miles of walking through these pods, there was a lot of squatting, stooping, and lifting as these robots brought shelves of merchandise to each person's station. I remember during orientation, our leader told us that we could expect to do thousands of squats and lifts on a shift. And she made this 1980s aerobics joke. She said, "Buns of steel, here we come," which is a reference to these videotapes that used to, it's kind of funny, but it's not because we're talking about people's bodies. And, one gentleman on my shift, I was on the night shift and it paid, gosh, maybe a buck an hour more. And people were seeking it out because of that. One gentleman had spent most of his career working as a mechanic in copper mines and his knees were shot. And for him, the stooping and squatting is probably worse than all that walking would have been. So watching him do that, I remember his wife, who was also probably at least in her 70s, was watching somebody going by and dusting the lockers, and she was saying, "I want that job. How do I get that job?" It was a challenge.
These camper force, and indeed the camp set up to accommodate it was set up as a result of the housing crash and the increase in van dwellers, or was that just a coincidence?
Well, that's fully debatable, right? I mean, I generally think any of these things are going to be a combination of factors. I don't think Amazon would ever say we capitalized on a housing crisis. That's not very good PR. But many people I met on the road were on the road in for reasons that did go back to the housing crisis. So, for whatever reason, the timing that Amazon discovered this workforce was really right after the housing crash. So, whether it was by accident or design, it definitely benefited the company.
It's tricky though, isn't it? I mean, if you see things as linear, which I know they're not, but imagine for a moment, you've got all these people on the road needing to earn a buck. And there's an Amazon factory, a fulfillment center, and it's offering money for a short space of time. So that's handy, isn't it? I mean, that's what I
Well,
meant
if we had
by
a
a
better
win-win.
social safety net, these people wouldn't be on the road to begin with. I
No,
mean,
well,
some of them
exactly.
might, but many
You
of them
need to
would
go
not.
further back than that. But I mean, given that there isn't an adequate social service, a social security net, then Amazon could claim to be doing a social service.
They could. I would disagree with that. I think we live in a winner-take-all economy right now, and I think not only do companies like Amazon profit off of that, but they push for it, and they're part of it. I mean, Amazon is a monopoly that does not want to be regulated. In the U.S., all of our antitrust legislation that was used back in the days of, just the giant steel and oil monopolies have fallen by the wayside in this age of digital and just kind of different monopolies. And I know the Biden administration has at least paid lip service to this. We now have Lina Khan, who is an anti-monopoly scholar at the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission. So I hope things will get better. But right now, everybody knows that that Amazon has pretty much been able to dictate its own terms when it comes to labor regulation. and a lot of people are hoping to see a change.
Further than that, Amazon also gets federal tax credits for hiring certain I learned this from your book, hiring certain categories of people, including the aging recipients of Supplemental Security Income. And also people on food stamps. So the workers are tax deductible.
They are, but the funny thing is they're gone very quickly too. I don't think that credit was really intended for people who were going to be working for, 3 months tops. So it's quite beneficial for the company.
I was reading an investigation that the New York Times did recently into life inside an Amazon warehouse, which you know about yourself. And they say that Jeff Bezos came to believe that an entrenched blue-collar workforce represented a march to mediocrity. And the more employee turnover you have, the keener workers are, and presumably the more compliant. Would you go along with that?
Not at all. But I think it's fascinating because we've always seen the effect of that on the floor at Amazon warehouses. The churn is incredible. The turnover is incredible.
I didn't ask. I didn't mean, would you go along with that modus operandi? And then would you agree with the New York Times findings?
Oh, so here's the interesting thing. I absolutely, it's been quite obvious for a long time that Amazon is happy to have attrition. They've been buying workers out. They love to tell everybody it's a job, not a career. And to read in that Jody Cantor New York Times story that not only has that been the practice, but it was actually part of Jeff Bezos's vision. So it's really considered a feature rather than a bug.
Interesting, isn't
that
it?
That impressed me, just how codified it was.
Yeah, yeah. That you would decide that short-term workers are better than long-term workers because effectively they're more powerless.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very deeply anti-humanistic view. And it's always struck me as this interesting paradox about Amazon where the whole paying lip service to the customer, we must serve the customer at all costs, the consumer. Well, workers are consumers and workers are family members and workers are, you can't really just take out one piece of human behavior and say you're going to serve that type of person and that somehow consumers mean something but workers don't. I mean, it's a very self-serving attitude.
I'm assuming that you never consume anything from Amazon.
I'm not going to lie to you. During the pandemic, particularly, I have consumed a couple things from Amazon. And part of the problem with Amazon is it squeezed a lot of other merchants out. I'm going to give you an example right now. I'm sitting on my couch, and I've got these lights in my ceiling. And they're these little doofy LED lights. And I used to be able to buy them on the internet from about 5 different places. And now Amazon is the only one that carries them at a normal rate. It's about $100 difference. And part of that is market pressures brought to bear by Amazon. So the problem is, as the market gets smaller and smaller, there become fewer and fewer opportunities. So I try not to shop Amazon. If it's $100 difference, sometimes people can't afford to not shop Amazon. And I urge people to make every decision in a conscious way. And if there's one thing you should never buy on Amazon, it's certainly books. But I also don't think that you either have to be a full boycotter or there's nothing you can do. I think right now the left gets into a bit of a circular firing squad where if you're not completely pure, you're worthless. Which, you know, it'd be really fun to tell you that I never buy Amazon, but occasionally I do.
Right.
I'm not completely pure, but I care and I do the best I can.
Yeah, I mean, that's all anybody can do, isn't it? The best you can. Let's talk about Linda May, who is in many ways the hero of your book. I mean, what a wonderful person to follow through while telling your larger story.
Yes, I'm incredibly lucky that Linda was so wonderful to spend time with because we spent a ton of time together. When I first met her in the Sonoran Desert at the Rubber Tramp Rendezvous, I am a little shy, believe it or not, and I approached her by asking if I could pet her dog. She jokes that that will be the name of her memoir, Can I Pet Your Dog? But if anybody had told either of us at the time of our meeting that she was going to be the main person in a magazine story that was going to go on to become a book, that was going to come on to be a film with Frances McDormand, and I would be following her around for 3 years, and then cameras would be there, we both would have asked what you were smoking. I mean, it just would have seemed completely ludicrous, and yet it happened.
She lived in a company town called Empire, which existed because of U.S. gypsum, and U.S. gypsum went broke, closed up in 2010. So effectively, the entire town had to go somewhere else or live without an income, correct?
Yeah, quick correction. The Linda May actually never lived there. Because the film is fictional, they were able to draw a through line from Empire to the Road.
Oh, excuse me.
Where, that's okay. I couldn't draw that direct through line. I mean, that's a narrative dream, but fictionally they were, with Fern, the main character of the film. She was out of Empire and then out in a van.
Ah.
I met a lot of people who were scrambling for things to do when they left Empire, but I didn't meet anybody, to the best of my knowledge, who ended up in a van.
All right. She came up against cheaprvliving.com, which mm-hmm. is the van dwellers guru Bob Wells's site. And he's another key character, of course. He became a good friend of yours, didn't he, Bob Wells?
Bob is great. He was a source of mine for a long time. And now I feel like he can be a friend. You know, you've got to, I try to keep my reporter hat on, which is always hard in immersion. But Bob is fantastic. He's done a lot of incredible things for a lot of people. And I am now, I can say I'm honored to count him as a friend.
You know, reading the book, and I don't think this is a unique experience by any means, I oscillated between feeling inspired and uplifted and angry and depressed. What about you?
I'm really pleased to hear that. I noticed today that you're also talking to Rebecca Solnit.
Yes.
On the show, and she's a huge inspiration of mine. And she wrote this amazing book called A Paradise Built in Hell that
yes.
explores some of these micro utopias that grow out of these terrible disasters. And it was George Orwell who also told us that so many of the human traits that we most admire, loyalty, bravery, resilience, courage, function in opposition to adversity. So while we wouldn't wish adversity on anyone, these forces are twinned, and things that may seem to be contradictory can often be true at the same time. So it pleases me to hear that you weren't able to distill it down to one thing or another or a complete moral. Rebecca also says, you can tell I'm a really big fan, it's our job to make things more complicated.
It's your job to make things more complicated. Well, you did
yeah,
do that
as
because, as you said, the nomads that you interviewed, you found were neither powerless victims nor carefree adventurers. The truth was much more nuanced. And nuanced is, of mm-hmm. course, a nicer word than complicated, but it means the same thing. And that's
sure.
why you got a van, right?
That's why I headed out on the road. Absolutely.
Tell me
Still
about,
have the van.
Tell me about what happens at the Rubber Tramp Rendezvous.
Oh, the Rubber Tramp Rendezvous is amazing. And I ended up there quite by accident when I was reporting for Harper's in 2014. And somebody on the camper force who I'd met said, I'm going to this thing, want to come with me? And at the time, when I showed up, what I saw was probably under 75 people who all lived on the road and were doing a two-week Skillshare. There were seminars on everything from how to get cheap dental care in the Molar City, which is Los Algodones, Mexico, where you can get, you know, crowns and implants for pennies on the dollar, to how to do stealth parking, basically staying overnight in cities without getting rousted by the police, and just teaching, basically sharing all sorts of road wisdom and also camaraderie and making friends and really creating a mutual aid network. And that was incredible. And at the time, there were so few people, and yet they wouldn't keep a tally, because if it was more than 75, they'd have to pay for a permit. Last time I went to the Rubber Tramp Rendezvous, it was probably around 8,000 people.
Right.
So the community has grown. by leaps and bounds.
And people, is that where people come to find community? Because I imagine it can be quite lonely if you're on the road, or maybe not now.
That is definitely a place where people go to find community. That's what Linda was doing there. She wanted to find her people because she didn't want to go out on the road to become a hermit. And there are a lot of people I met who consider themselves extroverted introverts. They like to have some social time, some connections, but they're also happy to have the solitude of being alone in a vehicle on the road. So I think for that personality type, it works especially well.
Could you?
People also, the people who meet there stay in touch also when they're not there. And once right. they've met,
thanks
they
to,
can keep thanks you know, relationships.
To the, thanks to the internet, I imagine.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Could you live on the road continuously for very long?
That's a great question. Could I? Probably. And, you know, there's some freedom in knowing that that would be possible, that if I needed to, for example, that's something that I could do. For me, I like doing things like having plants and going to the same pharmacy and having the person there know me. So while I love being on the road, I feel lucky in that I can go on and off, and I've continued to do that.
Right.
I actually just fixed up the van a few weeks ago. It got attacked by field mice during the pandemic, and I spent 2 days sanitizing it. But for me, I've been kind of a FOMAD, a fake nomad, rather than a full-on nomad. But I really admire people who are, you know, managing to do it full-time and finding fulfillment in that.
I mean, you need a certain amount of dollars in order to get a van. Some people just take to the road in their cars or with a tent in the boot or whatever. It's not, you don't need a vast amount of money to get one. I'm wondering if we're going to be seeing more of it in New Zealand because we're facing a housing crisis here and houses are unaffordable for more and more people, ridiculous prices. But what we don't have in New Zealand are vast Amazon warehouses where people can earn a buck.
Sure.
So we
sure.
May...
So is New Zealand a car culture? I would love to visit one day. I might get to visit next year. But so people do have, a lot of people have vehicles that could become shelters of last resort.
Yeah. And in fact are shelters of last resort, but they're usually kind of parked up in places and are now being moved on. And you've pointed out that a number of urban and rural cities across America have enacted laws that make it hard or nearly impossible to live in vehicles. And I'm sure it's the same in increasing number of places here. You want that to change, do you?
I would, especially because I'm worried about this intersecting with the eviction crisis. And I don't know if you have a similar situation there, but here we've had an eviction moratorium since the worst of the pandemic. And in terms of figuring out how to transition out of that moratorium, everybody's known this is going to be a problem, but we keep kicking the can down the road. And now the moratorium, they've said no more extensions. It's going to end at the end of this month. And only now is the federal government scrambling to try to patch these rental aid assistance systems that they were trying to put in place. Most of the states were given tons of aid that they did not distribute because of pretty much ineptitude. And now we're scrambling to make it work, which is really sad because we had more time to deal with this and we didn't use it.
The idea of choosing one's destiny is fabulous, of course. And I guess that's what van dwellers tell themselves. And Bob Wells says that van dwellers, he sees them as conscientious objectors from a broken, corrupting social order. Do you think that that might be overstating it?
I don't believe that any of us entirely choose our destiny. Do you know what I mean? We all live in certain contexts and have certain... There are forces that shape our choices. Now, what we choose to do within that palette of choices we have, whether there are many colors on the palette or only very few, that's where agency lies. So if it's interesting, even with Bob himself, when he was first on the road, he was crying himself to sleep and saying, I'm homeless, what do I do? And then he turned it around. And some of that was, you know, I'm skeptical of positive thinking in many ways. Now in the US, we talk about toxic positivity. And I'm skeptical when people use it to exploit other people or to say that social conditions shouldn't be better, that it's all in your head. But by the same token, if I were on the road, I need a reason to get up every morning. We all do. And perhaps I chose to live in a van rather than going to a shelter or sleeping on the couch of a child of mine that's really broke and can't afford to have me there. Perhaps I made that choice. Perhaps I've observed that consumer culture really is messing up our environment and our world. And I want to plant my flag in that. I don't see anything wrong with that either. So, again, this is one of these situations where it's complicated. I won't say that people are in denial, because everybody needs to plant a flag and get out of bed in the morning.
Yeah. Further complicated, of course, by the fact that you're burning up fossil fuels, which is, you know, not a thing that.
Yes! Although less than you'd think, because many people don't move around that much or that far. So if you look at, for example, a Los Angeles commuter, that's way crazier than what most of these people are doing. Or if you look at when we use jet fuel in terms of carbon emissions, a lot of these people have pretty small kind of migratory routes or aren't, traveling across the country every 5 minutes. So it could be overstated, but yeah, it's all on the same track.
Another thing you did on this immersive journey was took part in the sugar beet harvest, which is another seasonal type of work that the van dwellers go on. What's a sugar beet harvest about?
Sure. So in the US, at least, about half of our sugar comes from sugarcane, which most people here are familiar with, and also sugar beets, which many people are not. Sugar beets aren't like salad beets, they're much larger. You wouldn't eat them solo. They have to be processed into sugar. And they're grown in these beet fields. The harvesting now happens mechanically. But where people are needed is at these piling stations where the beets get piled up. And then they sit there and they're ready to be processed, basically. So when I was at the sugar beet harvest, I was in Drayton, North Dakota, right near the Canadian border in October. And at the start of the month, I believe it starts at midnight, they call it the campaign, and everybody's racing literally around the clock. There are 12-hour shifts going on all the time. And the farmers are racing to get the beets out of the field while they're at peak sugar. But before it freezes. So they're coming in these giant multi-ton haul trucks and they're dumping them into these piling machines that then spit them out and essentially create these gigantic beet mountains. Now you have a ground crew because there's a lot of spillage. So in my ground crew, whenever we were leading the diesel trucks in and helping them get unloaded, but between trucks, we would be running around with these agricultural scoops and just, busting our butts to shovel the beets that had missed the hoppers back into them. Now, some of them were the size of basketballs. Another thing we did was take samples where you're standing below the chute holding a giant vinyl bag and essentially pushing a button so beets will rocket down the chute into the bag. And it's like catching bowling balls in a pillowcase. So it really beat my body up. And I thought this was pretty wild because when I did this, I was in my mid-30s and people, when I was in the camp, there was one person who had to be in his 70s who'd been a Walmart truck driver who was losing his eyesight, not having an easy time with a job, was begging to get off night shift. And the people to my right were a couple of crust punks from Portland in their 20s sleeping in their pickup truck. So I was kind of in this weird middle ground where everybody was kind of a young punk and a traveler or older, just really, really needing the work.
I was just thinking about Barbara Ehrenreich, and she, for Nickel and Dime, didn't she work at Walmart?
She did. She
And
absolutely did.
Amazon seems to have overtaken Walmart as the kind of villain of choice for today's society, has it?
Oh, it's funny. I remember I was doing a piece on Amazon years ago, and Walmart at that point had better wages, and I've never had a press officer call me back so quickly
Oh.
because they were so happy to say, hey, we're better than that, because Walmart, often and rightfully so, gets kind of, poo-pooed on as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, but Barbara Ehrenreich is amazing. When I was in the van, I was listening to Nickel and Dimed, her book, which I had already read, and I'd forgotten. There's one section where she said, but I draw the line at living in a vehicle. And I was drinking this tepid gas station coffee, and I think I spat it all over myself laughing. I was thinking, what have I done? Here we go.
Another book that yours reminded me of was Catherine Boo's Behind the Beautiful Forevers. where she immersed herself in a Mumbai slum. Have you read that?
It's so nice to hear you say that, because these two women are huge inspirations to me. And I do think about them quite a bit. Yeah, her work is incredible.
Underlying Nomadland is this kind of fact, right? In the 1970s, the ratio of earnings of between a CEO and the employee was 29 to 1. And in 2019, it was 320 to 1. I don't know what it is now. Do you?
Mm-hmm. That's the latest that I've seen from the Economic Policy Institute, where that figure comes from.
320 to 1.
I know. How many donuts can one person eat?
I know. Next week, I'm talking to Dan Price, who is the CEO of a company called Gravity something or other, I can't remember, Seattle. So 5 or 6 years ago, he slashed his own $1 million salary, gave all his workers a minimum salary of $70,000, was clearly on a mission, and has done extraordinarily well. He hasn't...
That's wonderful to hear. I've heard of him, and I've been actually wondering. I heard about him a few years ago, and I've been wondering, how is it working out for
well,
that guy?
Well, he says, because... and by all reports, he's right, that it's working out very well. But he hasn't led the way, apart from four other CEOs of smaller companies. But, you know, Jeff Bezos didn't hear him, did he?
Well, no. I mean, because if Dan Price is doing that, Dan Price sees his employees as humans and as whole humans and as people. And he sees himself as a steward rather than just kind of this giant extractive oil rig on top of a mountain. So to me, I think it's fantastic that Dan Price has done that. And I wish people like Jeff Bezos would get a more rounded view of people and their value. And their value is more than consumers.
They seem to get around it, the very rich, by saying, look, we give gazillions of dollars to charity and philanthropy, and we couldn't do that if we paid people.
If we paid taxes?
If we paid taxes.
Sorry.
That's right. That's right. Do you think anything's going to change? I mean, you've got Biden now. Do you seriously think anything's going to change?
Oh, I sure as hell hope so. There's a great book on the kind of elite charade of philanthropy stuff called Winner Takes All by Anand Giridharadas.
Yeah,
if you're interested.
Him.
Oh, he's fantastic.
He is. Yeah. A really interesting book.
And really compelling speaker. I'm a big fan of his as well. But do I think things will change? You know, I'm a really lousy futurist because I didn't know that things would get more extreme when I was working on Nomadland. I was looking at inequality. I was thinking about the Gini coefficient, which shows us that, you know, among so-called developed nations, we're the most unequal. And I mean, it was a failure of imagination on my part, but I figured people had to be waking up in the wake of Occupy Wall Street, and then maybe things would get better. And they haven't. And the pandemic hasn't helped. So looking at what I hope will be more than a brief pause between horrible regimes. We've got this Biden moment, which is just like the country's been gasping for air, and now we have Biden. And I just don't know yet, because Trump undid so many things. It's just there's so much to do. We had so much to do before Trump showed up. And now we've got a short time to jump on it. So I am rooting for them wholeheartedly, but I can't, you know, promise anybody I think they'll do it.
What are you working on now?
Well, I've got to tell you, as an immersive journalist who does stories that are pretty much hidden in plain sight that anybody could have access to if they felt like showing up and spending the time, I can't tell you that.
Well,
the
we'll
only
have
advantage
to,
I have is
we will just have
that
to wait,
show up and do it.
We will have to wait a few years for it to emerge. Thank you for your time,
Hopefully
Jessica
the first part of it will come out sooner. Thank you, Kim. It's been a
Nomadland
pleasure.
Author Jessica Bruder. Nomadland, of course, and the subtitle being Surviving America in the 21st Century.